session number 29566, reel 16.
Les Spicer, reel 16.
Now, what we didn't realise, although we should have realised, because we'd had the experience of Mr. Starling before, he couldn't really leave patrolling alone. As I said, he was a lovely bloke. Really, even now, he's sorely missed. But Joe to be stuck behind the desk wasn't Joe. And he's called us all together one day and he said, "Now look, lads," he said, "I don't like this any more than you do." He said, "I know a lot of you have done it before," he said, "and you wanted a little bit of a rest," he said. "But surely intelligence is going out there and getting it ourselves." So we sort of looked at one another. And so he said, "What I suggest we do, instead of coming in uniform like we do now," he said, "I'll clear it with the CO. And he was very persuasive, John. He said, "I suggest we come to work in jungle kit." Because we used to, it was all jungle green, but we used to wear a beret for work. And, you know, the sergeants would have their stripes up and all that kind of thing. He said, "I suggest we come to work in jungle green as though you're going out on patrol. That means the lot, you know." He said, "Bring your small pack." He said, "Don't bother with rations," he said, "because we're not going to be out for any length of time." He said, "But what we could do," he said, we could go out on the odd jaunt, as he put it. He said, "And I think we might be able to get some information." So we left it like this. So next day we all came to the police station dressed, ready to go out on patrol. I mean, we always took our weapons everywhere we went, even just coming from the camp to go to the police station. But we were ready to go out, as it were. And one day, I think it was, Joe had got some information from a mate of his. He said, "I'm buggered if I'm going to share this with the rest of them." He said, "I think we ought to do this on our own." So we went out this day, and the section was made up entirely of intelligence section personnel. There was Joe, Sergeant Walker, Corporal Cox, myself. We had three other blokes with us who we'd borrowed. And he'd got some transport from somewhere. I don't know where he got the bloody transport from. I think he borrowed some police trucks, because he couldn't go back to the MT section, because the old man would have wanted to know where the bloody hell that lot are going. I think he got some police transport, and he dropped us. He told this the police lieutenant. He said, "Could your drivers take us to the north side of a place called Sungilong, or the village at the back of Sungilong?" And we were dropped off there, and we went back along the track, and unbeknownst to us at the time, we'd stopped, and he said, "Well, we better look as though we've got some sort of ambush position." So we set an ambush position up. But unbeknownst to us, there were some bandits coming along the adjacent track. Anyway, we were so surprised, and I mean, Joe was a good shot. But we were so surprised, we opened up, we didn't hit a bloody thing, we missed everything. But also, what we didn't know was the mortar platoon were out that day. And they'd set up an ambush position along the same track, but further up. And they ran into them, and they missed them as well. I mean, it's never, you know, a cast iron situation, because somebody walks into your position, you're going to get them. We'd missed them, they missed them, and all we can assume that they, well, they must have got away with it, because we couldn't find anything. We didn't find any blood spots or packs or anything, but they were bloody lucky that day. But that was the sort of situation. But we used to go out, and we did find the odd message secreted here and there. One day we went out to, or rather a night job it was, we ambushed a coffee shop in a little village. We didn't have any specific information, it was just a hunch, I think, on Joe's part. We ambushed this coffee shop all night, and we saw people coming and going and drinking cups of coffee, and men sitting down there smoking, playing mahjong, and generally jabbering away, and we didn't understand a word they were saying. But then it all went quiet, and we all went to kip, I think. We had a couple of sentries out. But we broke into this place about 6:30 the following morning. And the poor bloody family that were inside, they must have wondered what hit them. There was an old woman and a bloke about the same age, and a younger man. But they swore blind they hadn't had anything to do with bandits. The only thing that we did find, and they did get into trouble over it, was we found upstairs in the top part of this place, we found 8 big bales of khaki material, which the bandits used for uniforms and hats. So we confiscated this lot, called a wagon, put them all on the wagon with the family, and took them to the local police station, and the police, I think, questioned them, and they charged the younger bloke with supplying the bandits with uniform material or something. We didn't find any arms or ammunition, but that was another incident that we went out on. And we weren't very successful, but we think the material may have been a little bit suspicious.
With something like that, had you been given any kind of training on how to search a premises?
No, not really. We just went in, got all the people to one side, and just went through it like a, you know,
looking for anything.
Anything that was suspicious, we used to just.
Would you say those people, though, were part of the kind of greater sort of supply that the bandits would have?
I think so, yeah. I mean, to be fair to them, they were living in total fear. It was, I mean, unless they were hard and fast Minyun, which were dedicated, like the Fifth Column during World War II, they were dedicated, hard, nosed people that knew what they were doing. They were supplying information, food, material, even doing a lot of the printing for them in these hand cranked presses. Most of them were unarmed Minyun, but there were a few armed Minyun. They used to secrete the odd pistol about themselves. A lot of them used to supply ammunition. They used to put it up the handlebars of bikes. We found it up the handlebars of bikes. They used to secrete it all over the place. We've even had, there was one bloke pulled in. He was searched. We took him in, and he was searched by CID. And he had three rounds of 9mm up his arse. They used to do all sorts.
How did it work with the police? What was the relationship that you had within the section and the local police force?
When we were there, I would say it was good. Now, I've heard that when the battalion first went there, and in the very early days, and we're going back to when the emergency really started in 1948, from 48 up to 49, it was chaotic. The police hadn't got a clue. They didn't know what time of day it was, and the cooperation was non-existent because they thought the military didn't really ought to get involved. It was their problem. And there was, even at high level, and we're talking commissioner level and above, they didn't like the interference of the military. They thought the military should have kept their noses out of it. And this sort of situation is made very clear in a couple of books, which I will give you at a later date. If anybody wants to read the where's and why for's and the how's and the whole situation about the Malayan emergency, there are two books in particular that explain the whole situation from day one, and the cooperation or the non-cooperation between the military and the police is very evident in these two books, but I'll give you those at the end.
How did it work on a day-to-day basis, though, with you? Would you exchange information?
There was the police lieutenant who was usually a young English chap. Most of them were ex-Palestine police. They were there nearly all the time. They used to exchange with us on a day-to-day basis. Invariably, the higher up rank, the officer commanding police district, that usually had a particular district under his control and had probably a dozen police lieutenants in different areas within that district, he would come into the operations room and discuss the situation with the intelligence officer, and to a lesser extent, the OCPD, the officer commanding police, the OCPC, the officer commanding police circle, who had a greater area, he would come in perhaps once or twice a week, and they would have a big powwow of where they thought. They would pull all the information because they all had various sources of information. Although it was there weren't too many people at that time coming forward with information. Not the ordinary Chinese. I mean, the Malays weren't really a problem. They didn't see it as their problem. I mean, in all the time I was there, I think of all the bandits we killed, we only killed two Malay bandits. Every other bandit was Chinese. Chinese were the main bandit source.
And what significance was placed on identifying individuals, and how was that done?
Well, the police had, as I said, they did have their informers, although trying to put a mole into a bandit section really didn't work. They did try it, but it wasn't very successful, because most of these bandit gangs knew one another from the old days of the Japanese occupation. They'd lived through man and boy. They'd come up through the ranks. So anybody new introduced who came out of the blue was instantly a suspect, so they didn't tell them anything. And the life within a bandit group apparently was pretty harsh. Apparently, communism was in the old style communism, you know, they were given daily carders, and if they didn't do this, that and the other, they were punished and that sort of thing. But you did get quite a lot of information from people, various people coming. Quite a lot of information came from rubber tappers. Rubber tappers in the main were Malay. They were fairly loyal to the planter who was in charge of the plantation. Invariably they were either English, Scottish or Welsh, or one or two Irish. There was one particular chap that we got to know quite well. We got to know all the planters really, because they lived, most of them lived in outlying districts. Their bungalows were like fortresses. But their tappers would come in and say, we think we've seen such and such and so. Although they were frightened, they would do it in such a way as not to bring too much suspicion upon themselves. And the rubber rubber planters themselves, the managers and the assistant managers, they had quite a good knowledge of what was going on their particular estate. They would get information, odd bits of information. It might seem, you know, very insignificant, but they would pass it on anyway. They might come up with all sorts of peculiar things. They might, you know, some bloke hadn't turned up for work the following morning, and they would wonder why. They might go along to his place of where he lived, and they'd find that he'd either been beaten up or something or other, or something even worse. And the wife might come up with something. I mean, you know, if somebody of your family's been killed or severely beaten up, some of them were not bothered really whether the people that did it came back, because they'd seen what they did to their loved ones, and they'd say, well, there were three of them in here last night and they wanted food, and he said he wouldn't give them any, so they beat him up, or they sliced him across the chest with a parang or something like that, and they said they're coming back in 2 days' time. So that they, you know, he'd pass that on to the local police, and the police would come in and they'd set an ambush up. It might work, it might not work. They might sit there all night long and nobody turned up, because either they'd thought better of it or they'd got wind that somebody was in the area. They didn't bother.
And would the gang members, if you had, because you mentioned when you were on patrol, you sometimes find photographs, would that be part of the intelligence section that you had? Would you collect photographs?
Yeah,
of individuals?
Yeah, all in the police station, and the ops room was sort of then put into one, as it were. And on one wall we had, particularly in Kajang, where we had the Kajang gang, we had what was known about the members of the Kajang gang, who was the leader, who was the 2IC, how many sections they had, what we thought they were armed with. And as these people were bumped off, they would put a red cross. The police or the IO would come along with a red pencil or a red marker and put a red cross. And that's how, and this system worked in every area in the Federation of Malaya. Because, as I say, there was 10 states and they were all ruled by different sultans.
And would you have anything within the any duties within the intelligence section once the bandits had been killed? Would they be photographed, or would you take documents from them?
If there was documents recovered at the time, they would all be brought into the police station and they would be gone through with a fine-tooth comb, mainly by the police, because they had Chinese. There was a lot of Chinese police as well. Apart from, and that was known as the Federation of Malaya Police Force. But there was a lot of Chinese detectives. They had very good communication skills. A lot of them had come over from Hong Kong. They'd been members of the Hong Kong police as well. Some of them could speak three or four dialects of Chinese. Some of them spoke Malay. And they could go through a pack and they would pick out the slightest bit of perhaps a cigarette paper that loads and loads of Chinese characters written on, and they, to you and me, wouldn't mean a thing, but they would get something out of that. It might be a set up for a next meeting, or how many rounds of ammunition they'd got, or what food was like, you know, how, were they down to the last tin of beans and that sort. Any bit of information from packs were taken and gone through with a fine tooth comb. Bodies were normally brought in to the police station on the back of a wagon. They'd been carried out on a pole, put on the wagon when the patrol was picked up. The bodies would be brought back into the police station with the patrol still on the wagons. And if the person was beyond recognition, the CID used to take fingerprints, but where the face was intact, you would usually have a photograph taken. And if that photograph didn't correspond with anything that you'd got on the wall, that would go up. And usually somebody knew who that person was, either a local inhabitant, because they used to get them to come in. The local inhabitants would come in, but they would identify the body or the head from behind the screen. Nobody ever knew who was identifying the body, because that would have got back to the bandits, and the bandits would have probably come into the local village that evening and sought out the person who had identified that person. Didn't matter whether he was dead or alive, if they identified a dead body, it was still giving the security forces information.
Was there occasions when it was surprising who were bandits? Were some of these people were they ever in a position of responsibility or trust?
I can't really answer that one. I don't ever remember that situation arising. I've come across plenty of situations where people have identified bandits that they didn't really think were bandits. That, you know, to all intents and purposes, they were doing a normal job, but they didn't know that they were sneaking off and were part of the bandit organisation. A lot of them were active Minyuin, but there were some were active bandits that uniformed, what I call uniformed bandits, that used to occasionally drift back into village life and live, in inverted commas, a normal life, if you will, just to pick up information of what was going on in the local area. Then they would flit off again. I mean, they had quite a good communication system, the bandits, at one time. They were very, very sophisticated.
Are there any other incidents that occurred during that period that spring to mind?
There was one incident one night that I can tell you about, was when Mr. Starling said to me, would I like to take out four members of the Royal Australian Air Force that were taking out, they were supposedly testing equipment, and they wanted to go out on a night ambush. Yeah, one day we were about to close up shop at the intelligence office, and Joe said to me, "Are you doing anything tonight?" Which, from an officer, is unusual. It's, you know, you're going to do this, going to do. He said, "Are you doing anything this evening?" So I said, "No." So he said, "You wouldn't like to take out four Australian Air Force men, would you?" He said, "They want to experience a night ambush." So, I mean, I couldn't really refuse, could I? So he said they were testing various items of equipment, and they asked if they could go on a night ambush. Anyway, I got back to camp, and I went to the armoury. I handed in my rifle, and I got myself an Australian Owing gun. I thought to myself, I'll make them feel at home. Got myself an Australian Owing gun and seven magazines of ammunition. I had one on the carbine itself and six in two pouches of three each side. I had a water bottle, and that was all. No other equipment. Oh, a smoke grenade or a phosphorus grenade and a couple of ordinary Mills 36s clipped in my belt as well. So I was travelling light. And these four blokes had been invited to the officers' mess. I think one was an officer, or maybe two, but they were given the treatment by the officers' mess. They'd had dinner in the mess or something. And they came out and they were introduced to me, and we took a 1500 weight truck. And beforehand, Mr. Starling had said to me, "We don't really want to put these people in a situation where you could run into trouble," he said, "because there's only five of you." So he said, "But to give them a smell of it," he said, "I suggest you ambush a place what was known as the Bukit Raya Bridge," which was a small bridge, small humpback bridge over a river. It wasn't very wide, but it was reasonably deep. But it was an area that bandit activity had been in. But of late, it had been fairly quiet. So the transport dropped us off, and we made our way in. It wasn't terribly thick. It was fairly clear, sort of secondary jungle. And we set up an ambush on the bridge about 30 yards from the bridge. But we were quite well concealed. And that was about 7:30 in the evening. Now, we stayed there for 6 hours. About 6 hours it was. And, I mean, I'd got everything. I'd got me little thing that you pull down over your hat, the close mesh. And I could hear all these bloody mozzies flying around. These poor buggers were getting bitten to buggery because they'd just got jungle gear on and a rifle or whatever. But they had no other protection on at all. I mean, I'd got the old muffler around the neck and everything pulled down. But, you know, these things, they sting through anything. But I was fairly comfortable. Anyway, at about 1:30, we started to hear some noises, and it was fairly distant at first. You could hear one or two muffled voices and a bit of splashing, and gradually as time went on, it got louder. And it got nearer.